Welcome, welcome, welcome back to Halal Cartels, dude. Okay, so yes, I've been back for a week now, and Samir, I'm burning the candle at both ends, I gotta say.
Tell me.
Okay, let me tell you. So this week was my first week back in person at an office in 19 months, and I don't understand how people did this during the pandemic. One of the things that I was so excited about was the end of commuting. And so this week, it's not that any of this is like a huge cross to bear, but after so much time off, you know, jobs have to factor in like juice breaks. You know what I mean? They need to factor in nap time. They need to factor in doom scrolling. Like back in the day, people had cigarette breaks. We need doom scrolling breaks. we're like, all right, everybody, pull out your iPhones and start scrolling. Okay, you've got 15 minutes for Instagram. Do it, you know, because I have the discipline now of a kindergartner.
Yeah, I can't fathom it. I honestly can't fathom it. I was thinking about it today. I was like, what would it be like to go back to 2019?
Yeah.
Like, I would go to offices. I would spend an abnormal amount of time at the office, too, because I work in advertising outside of comedy, and there would just be, everybody would always have a fire when there wasn't a pandemic. They'd be like, oh, fuck, we have like a problem. Everyone needs to stay at the office till an insanely late hour. And I just couldn't fathom it anymore. I mean, to be honest with you, though, working in that world after the pandemic, they would be like, cool, we'll just meet back up at 9 p.m. Where are you going to be? There's nowhere to go, so. We'll see it now.
Yeah, so they find a way. They justify it because they're like, "Wait, yep, you're going to be home, right?" I think for me, the biggest challenge is just, you know, wearing dress shoes again and pants. Like,
you have to wear dress shoes, or can you wear sneakers?
Well, the first day we all showed up and everybody was wearing a fit. You know, everybody had their first day at school type outfits.
Yeah,
just real, real nice, put together, color coordinated. And then day two, we all wore sneakers.
Hell yeah.
But it was 5 days of job training, like our professional development. And, yo, I was starting to get cranky, man. I was not.
I'd have been cranky when I got there.
Yeah, you're cutting into my YouTube time.
The best part, I think, of what we're talking about is how jobs went remote and people were more productive with juice breaks, YouTube time, and doom scrolling.
Yeah.
And, like, unattended shit. Than they were when everyone was like lording over them like hawks. That's what's fascinating to me, is we're no longer spending time posturing and being fake as fuck. And we're actually spending the appropriate amount of time on the tasks that we're supposed to do. And because we know that we don't have to posture, we just do the things efficiently and we do them well. And then we do whatever the hell else we were going to do.
So a 5-hour professional development could be summed up in an email with 15 bullet points in bold and then links to the proper Zooms. And that is it. Just give me a step by step. This is what you need to do. We don't need to have a person explaining all of it for a ridiculous amount of time. Also, we had like a sexual harassment training workshop as well. And it's like, well, I'm not around anybody to harass. So why am I taking this?
Bro, I gotta tell you, I worked on this TV show on HBO. I won't say which one it was, but people will probably find my name in the credits.
Bear but... Devil.
And like, it was called John from Cincinnati. It was a raging success.
Yeah.
No, so they had a lawyer come in to do the sexual harassment training, and during it, they posed a question where they were like, you and your friend from work go out for drinks after work. It's just you two. Then a coworker shows up and sees you at the bar. They come chat you up. It's after hours. Something comes up that's like sexual in nature. They feel uncomfortable. Is that okay or is that not okay? And I was like, that's a tough question, right? Because like, this is a punisher from work that like spots you.
They sought you out.
They found you at the bar. They're like, oh, let me come over and like engage in your conversation. And
they're like, what are you doing over here? And you're like, I'm drinking creme de menthe shots. Like, clearly you're about to have a slithery conversation about something sensual and sumptuous.
But the funniest thing was how somebody that I worked with was like, raised their hand and was like, that is not wrong. They're invading your space. And then the lawyer was like, no, actually, that counts as like contributing to a hostile work environment. And then she was like, but who is this snitch?
Yeah.
And we all died of laughter. Yeah. But those are normally the dumbest. They go like, somebody like comments on like Susan's like massive like double D breasts. Like, is that appropriate in the workplace? And it's like, no, obviously not. Who is this fucking freak? Like,
yeah. You don't talk about anybody's body at the workplace
ever.
When you're on the clock.
You never even go like, you look good in that shirt. I do not engage in any of those conversations. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
If somebody literally was bald the day before and comes in with a full blown like wig on and now they have like fake ass hair, I don't go like, hey, cool hair. I don't say shit.
I felt weird commenting on my own clothes. I wore one of the shirts I brought back from Medellin.
Yeah.
On day three, and they were like, nice shirt. And I was like, yeah, this is my Narcos shirt. And then like the girl from Mexico was like, oh, don't talk about Narcos.
And you were like, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I was like, my bad.
It said it on the tag. I'm not trying to make you uncomfortable.
Yeah. I'm sorry about what's happening in your country right now. Yeah. So anyway, sometimes you can comment on your own clothes and it's harassment.
Yeah, I just don't engage. I'm so flat, like mm-hmm. sexual vibes in the workplace, not for me. I refuse. I go like, all I like is to talk about nothing at
yes.
all. I will literally never give any information about myself.
Away. Yeah, what's his personality? Radio static.
Yeah, I just go like, no, cool. You like water? So do I. We're at the water cooler. I'm like, gotta mm-hmm. stay hydrated. All right, guys. See you later.
Not too hot, not too cold.
Exactly. Flat as fuck.
So, yeah, man. Work. So burning the candle at both ends, right? I'm going to work every day, which is fine. You know, I'm just grateful, thankful. Hashtag blessed. Yes, thriving. But then at the same time, you know, comedy is one of those weird things where you get booked. Sometimes there's feast or famine. And this week I was doing two spots every night. And that was to brag, haha. But you know, when you got to wake up early and then you got to go to the shows, and the only thing you're getting paid in is drink tickets, my liver was taking a hit. And I got to shout out one show that I loved, though. There's a show I did this week called Schmooze,
yeah,
on Tuesday, and it's hosted by Chase DeRosso and Lucy Pohl. And the reason I'm giving it a shout out is like most comedy shows are the same. But this one, Lucy and Chase, they give musical intros and crowd work. And then they had Dylan Adler playing piano. So it felt like, you know, it felt like with the musical improv-y intros, it was like very KRS-One meets Frank Sinatra. And with Dylan tickling the keys, this all being in the East Village gave me flashbacks to like when I started stand-up and the East Village was like a cool alt, you know, scene, right? Because like it wasn't just stand-up we were watching. I was like, you guys don't appreciate, like, the young audience. I was like, you don't appreciate how cool this is.
Yeah, I love Dylan. Shouts to Dylan. And Lucy, I know Lucy, we've had her on.
Yeah, and Chase did Funhouse too, like 2 weeks ago. So funny.
Oh.
Yes,
so
sir.
Like, yeah, we've had all of them, but that sounds great.
Yeah.
Tell me, so I remember when I got here, the way shows used to be, but I was still like kind of like late to the game. Like the Lower East Side comedy scene was out of control.
Yeah, well, as New York City is gentrified and developed, you know, the East Village was Bushwick in the early aughts, and then Williamsburg got built up because the L train's just one stop. So then, as more affordable and safe housing for recent graduates from art schools in Iowa moved to New York, you know, things started moving on the L line further and further out. But at this moment in time, you know, the early aughts and the late 90s, the East Village was the heart of the alt comedy scene. You know, and if you're walking up and down Avenue A, First Avenue and Second Avenue, and all the shows are there, you're bumping into all the comics doing spots, you know, whereas now the scene is like fragmented all over the city. So we're not necessarily going to see the best comics in Harlem or the Bronx if we're doing shows in like Northern Brooklyn, because they have to travel through that wasteland that is Manhattan to get to do our show at Funhouse specifically.
Hell yeah.
But I remember when I started, one of the very first book gigs I ever got, maybe like, because aside from bringer shows. So one of the very first book gigs I got was in the East Village. And I was at a house party where there was like live music. And I'm waiting in line for the bathroom. And one of my friends, this woman goes, "Oh, you got to meet this guy. He also does comedy." So like there's this very nerdy dude standing right in front of me. And I was nerdy looking too. So, but when I say that, it's like very mild mannered looking dude standing in the bathroom line in front of me. And he's like, "Hey man, my name is Schaefer. You want to come do my show? You can do my show." And sight unseen, he didn't know anything about me. He's like, "You can do my show." And I didn't know anything about this guy, but this, you know, my friend's like, "He's great. Oh my God, he's like famous." So now I'm like getting a little bit like in my head, okay, I'm doing this famous guy's show. He didn't look like much, you know? And then I get to this bar in the East Village and Schaefer is dressed to the nines in an all black suit, skinny black tie. And he's this nerdcore rapper, Schaefer the Dark Lord, who's hosting this event, and all of his rhymes are about Star Wars and whatnot. And he had a huge following at that time. And so I'm sitting with him. And I thought it was going to be like a traditional stand-up show, but it's me. I'm going on after a guy who is wearing a fishbowl homemade astronaut helmet and who has a prosthetic vagina that he's put on his like a cod piece. It's Mangina, and that's the guy's name. So,
so Schaefer, apropos,
yeah. So Schaefer goes up and does like he spits bars, like nerdcore bars about those ice walkers on Hoth and Jedis, and then Mangina goes up and is asking people to put their hands inside of his prosthetic vagina. This Shania Twain impersonator goes up, and then they ask me to go up with my had just written maybe 4 months into the game. Seinfeld like observations that tanked hard.
What's the deal with trees? It smells yeah. like feet.
Yeah. Paper clips.
Where was that? Do you remember the venue?
I can't tell you for the life of me, but it was in the East Village and it was between Avenue A and First Avenue and Avenue A, probably like on 5th or 6th Street. So, like the heart of the East Village, you know, in a venue that's absolutely closed at this point.
I'm sure.
But what I found interesting was like now we do have an alt comedy scene and we do have comics who are characters, but I feel like it was just so much more, this isn't to be nostalgic, but that there was that more of the alt stuff was still in the heart of Manhattan.
I fucking love that, dude. I mean, like that's absolutely what I learned when I got here. I think it was just trickling into Brooklyn, but really that alt stuff in Manhattan was now spreading into Brooklyn. And I remember a lot of comedians that would only do shows in Manhattan were like, "Ugh, it's in Brooklyn."
Yeah. Also, these weird things like that seem so magical because they were undocumented. Now everybody has a phone, right? So
right.
you can take your set directly off of an open mic and post a minute of the open mic where you killed and get viral off of a joke you've told once that was of the moment. Whereas, you know, when I would tell people, "You wouldn't believe it, but this guy had a prosthetic vagina," and four of my friends like got their hands locked up to the wrist inside that thing simultaneously. No one believes it, right? Or like, you know, you have to imagine it.
I remember when I moved out here, YouTube was just beginning to burgeon, and it was like gameable. You could basically get the most views, and then people, when they went to YouTube, would sort by most views. So you could establish yourself by just getting views and like fake views. I never did it, but I knew that because I was working on some YouTube stuff back then. And I went to a bar and ran into like two people from the comedy scene and began to talk to them about this. And I was like, look, man, comedians are too precious about their material. You can build a following. It's decentralized now. And the platform is YouTube. You can use YouTube, tag things. You used to be able to tag Jack, which meant you could go on YouTube, see an amazing comedian's video that got tons of views, and they would show you the tags that they used on their video, under the video. You could copy and paste those tags into your video and now compete with that comedian.
Tag jacking.
And so, and you know, like,
can anyone tag Jack anymore?
No, they completely changed the game on that. And they started decentralizing, like, as much as possible, the information about how successful those tags would be. And then they, through the algorithm, have weeded out anyone who tried to do something like that, like deconstruct a video. But I remember I came through this punk philosophy. I was like, look, I grew up in the punk and hardcore scene. Everything's ephemeral, right? Topical jokes are ephemeral. You're only going to be able to tell a topical joke for a few weeks before it's old hat. Who the fuck wants to hear about a year ago's topical joke? Never again. So how do you make the most of that? So I gave them this whole spiel. Like, it was Tommy Lucente, who, you remember Tommy, ran Van Halen.
Absolutely.
And Don Stahl, who was like a comedian. I don't even know where he wound up. But they were at Soft Spot. I was told them this whole spiel, and I was like, I'm a punk. I'm going to fucking put all this stuff on YouTube. And then I immediately changed my mind and went in about face because of the hierarchy and the politics of the comedy scene out here. Was like, very much the minute you become self-aware and you're like, oh, there's a like system here, and you can't just like go putting your shit up and blowing up. You have to like, if you really want to be a comedian, you have to like be about the craft and the art. And here we are 10 years, 11 years later. And I'm like, I wish I took my own fucking advice back then, you know? And, but things have changed so much, man. That was like back when I met you. And, you know, a couple of years probably after that show that you were talking about is when we met each other.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Our first talk, where we connected was discussing the movie Carlos, which was like the 3-part French miniseries on the Venezuelan freedom fighter / terrorist /
Carlos the Jackal.
Yeah, / what was he? He was like the Soviet James Bond.
Dude, I can't believe you just brought that. It's so apropos to this podcast too. Can you imagine, dude, like a decade later, here we are, chilling together, making Halal Cartels, but that was what we talked about.
Yeah.
And we were introduced by Jenna Friedman. She was like, my friend Gabe's going to come with me to the show. And Kurt Bronneler was there. You did the show. I put on a show at Public Assembly.
Yes.
Now called Music Hall of Williamsburg.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did the show, and we like chatted it up, and I was like, yeah, I fucking like this guy. And then we became friends because of that.
Yeah, and I was like, do you have you seen Battle of Algiers?
Yeah, you did, and I had it on DVD. I bought it from Criterion Collection. I still have it.
Yeah. So that's where we're at. That's so funny you brought up algorithms earlier, by the way, though.
Yeah.
And I was just joking. I sent somebody the last two things Instagram had posted for me, and one of them was a like just an influencer talking about negative emotions.
Feel them, we're gonna get stuck feeling them. But what gets you stuck is actually not the emotions, but rather the story you attach to the emotions.
Okay, so nonsense like that gets sent to me, and then immediately after that was my favorite Instagram, which is look at this Russian.
I and, love that. It used to be look at this fucking Russian.
Yeah.
God, I see you.
Anyway, it's just a guy with half of his teeth drinking vodka while riding atop of a grizzly bear. And I don't know what tranquilizers they gave that bear, but its mouth is open and its teeth are razor sharp.
Dude, I gotta say this. So now that we're reminiscing, I love the theme of what we're talking about, because I've got to say this one thing. So the social media game has completely corrupted society, but it's really had an insidious and like demented effect on comedy. And before I left the house today, I was talking to my wife about this because she was talking about a director she knows who went on social media and talked about the negative effects of social media, right?
Yeah.
And he was talking about how, despite his success and how he feels about his success, going on social media makes him feel small and like a timid shadow of the person he always wanted to be.
It's like Alice in Wonderland and she eats the wrong muffin and it makes her tiny.
Tiny. And that's social media, right? And during the pandemic, this was a craze, right? I've worked with social media in an official capacity as a consultant for a long time. I'm not going to give away too much, but I have worked with, like, you know, a majority of these platforms in many different capacities.
Snoogle.
Yeah, Snoogle. That's like the least of the one. I mean,
Brinder.
Yeah.
It's where Brinder. It's where you meet people who like to brine hams. Do you want to salt this slab of meat with me?
Are you trying to brine a turkey? It's Thanksgiving. It's the social media platform for you.
Yeah.
But one thing I will say is
ChewTube.
ChewTube.
Exclusively for bras mukbang. Who like to eat.
It's like mukbang videos only. ChewTube. You just created a new company, and I don't even know if we should give this away on the platform.
For all my masticators out there.
On the podcast. I love saying the word platform, too. It just said it. But no, I honestly, ChewTube is genius, and I don't know if it exists. But
Blue ChewTube.
It's just like dudes' dicks get out of control, smashing things while they eat. They're like, I have a boner, and I'm feasting. ChewTube? Blue ChewTube sponsored. But one thing I did realize is during the pandemic, the comedy scene was a mess. So you had... like, what do you call chuds that were like underground, like dwellers that were doing comedy for each other, and they were doing like open mics
on the Zoom open around. Mics.
No, not even Zoom. In real life, they never stopped.
Ooh, doing
speakeasy mics where they were passing COVID around to each other,
COVID
and
basement
breaking all
fight
the
club.
Rules, and but they were all like. Demented toilet lords, and so they were not like good at comedy, but they were addicted to open mics, and they're handing like COVID out to each other, and or they were like comedians who were like, you know, like just couldn't not get the reps in. And so during that time I realized that comedy was dead, right? And so we were looking at basically people who were of that caliber doing mics, which were not rewarding and were a bit scandalous. And then it segued to actual shows, but they had to be masks. They had, you know, there was all these precautions when they started being allowed to do comedy, right? Or it had to be outdoors. Like, there was really no indoor stuff. The point I'm trying to make here is, social media played an integral role in who got booked on those spots. And who got booked on those spots is who kept popping up in the algorithm. And who pops up in the algorithm, right? It's people who curate and work heavily on social media to curate a vibe, curate a persona. And so who are those people that are getting enough engagement in order to be the first on the algorithm for other comics? They're strappers. So it was like hot chicks and hot dudes. Legit. It was just like people who were like,
I like this.
Here's like a thong pic of my like insanely fit ass. You like could see.
Here's our vocabulary so far is tag jackers.
Yes.
And thirst trappers.
Yes. You already know.
In the wild.
Yeah. And you can tag jack on Instagram, by the way, because it's it's like, okay, I'll just heist all of your hashtags. But the end all be all of it is you had a whole group of comedians who were established and were hungry to do comedy, but were reluctant to do it because of this virus, who are watching thirst trappers murder it with the limited number of shows that existed in their outdoors and whatever. You weren't getting booked even if you had a special. You had to go out and have like a good thong pick or like, you know what I mean? Like, cleavage pick, or be like, a hot dude or something, or be like that social person.
Yeah, dude, I'm throwing myself in hammocks with my shirt off.
Exactly. And so what does that have to do with the craft? It has nothing to do with the craft. It's that you appear in the algorithm, and so that's who is getting booked. And so the insidious nature of the algorithm attacked the comedy scene, where it made people who already feel inadequate and miserable feel way more so. And then they have to watch all these people who they know are less talented than them and know have not put in the level of commitment and care and interest in this art get booked while they couldn't. Because we live in a city where right now, as we speak, there's just an overflow of shows. There's just so many. And I'm not complaining about that by any means.
But
I love it.
But the only two that you need to worry about, everybody, are Funhouse every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. at Pete's Candy Store. And every first and third, second and fourth Saturday, Big Break at
Second
Bluebird.
And fourth Saturday.
Yes.
Big Break, baby.
So Funhouse and Big Break, and you can find both of those on Instagram.
But you know what, dude? Those that's the whole thing. Like, people started up all these shows during the pandemic, and I'm happy that there are more shows and stuff, but the people that they booked were, a lot of them were newcomers. They were just masters of thirst trapping on social media. So what it did was invalidate the art, invalidate the meritocracy of this business, which doesn't really exist. We can do a whole other episode of this. We could do a Patreon with other comics to talk about this. But the reality is image, visage, bullshit is what travels in this business a lot. You know, unless you're really hands on and you build your own audience brick by brick, you'll be intimidated by the newcomers, the fucking sexier people, the people who aren't remotely as talented, but they look good.
Well, that's why I think, you know, if you care about the craft, that's a personal decision to care about the craft. It does not equate to success, and it doesn't equate to the show in show business. It's the art. So it's dividing. We've got to separate this into almost like three prongs, right? Because there's the art, which is the craft. And it's like if you're a poet learning how to write the perfect haikus. But then there's the show, which is wearing the thong, waxing the chest, getting the pasta pecs. You know what I mean? Getting the lineup. Look at, you know, fresh, clean.
Yeah.
And then there's the business, which is how do you monetize that?
Of course.
You know?
And two of those three things can exist without the talent. For sure. And they do. And that's the reason I say this is that there is an epidemic right now. We've talked about this for years. I've talked about this literally years ago at Funhouse, where I talked about right before the first Trump election, I called this out and I was like, look, Facebook, Instagram have a vested interest in divisive material. It keeps you on longer. You're arguing with idiots. You're on site longer and you're being advertised during that time. And so they recently, everyone who's seen this knows this, but there's a congressional hearing.
Yeah, that's right.
With the whistleblower of Facebook/Instagram last week. And she said straight up that they knew this and that they used it as a tool to make more money. But I knew this years ago and I would evangelize it myself. They have a vested interest in you being miserable and angry on there because it'll keep you on there longer.
Well, what's wild is that she's the whistleblower that's getting the optics. And I think part of it is because she's cute. And I think it's of the moment. But this is something that people, like you've said, have been saying forever. And we've known this forever. Like, I feel as though I was hearing articles like this or this message a decade ago, when people were saying that you're the product. If it's free, you're the product.
Yo, for listeners, that everyone check this out. This is a true story, right? So a decade ago, I think I talked to you about this. This is maybe 8 years ago, not a decade ago. There was a thing that Facebook did where they used users on Facebook as a different control groups. They picked people at random. And it was thousands of people, and they showed certain people, when they were developing the algorithm, they showed certain people happy stuff, and they showed certain people miserable and depressing things, and they watched what happened, right? And they watched the impact those people had on their followers and friends, right? The thing that was interesting was these people were all neutral from my understanding. They were all kind of neutral from the beginning. And the whole plan for the experiment was, if we show people happy stuff, will they go on to be happier people? And will they influence people to be happier people? If we show them negative things, what will happen? Will it be the opposite, right? The concept was called social contagion theory. One of the things that happened in that congressional hearing was they talked about the research capacity of Facebook and Instagram, right? Facebook as a company. They have the most robust. This woman came from Google, from Pinterest, all these other places. Facebook has a research machine, right? If you look into Sesame Street, for example, when Sesame Street was developed as a TV show, they almost never went live. They couldn't figure out how to make children pay attention to what they were doing. So what did they employ? They employed vision tracking. They literally studied the way children reacted when they saw something on screen by their the tracking their eyes.
Wow, this is so Blade Runner. It's like the Voight comp test.
Dude, but when was that? That was like the 1970s, 1980s, whatever the hell that was, right? That's how they hacked it. That's how they figured it out. You want to know what they figured out? They figured out that when puppets were on the screen, the kids paid attention more. So they employed the use of puppets, right? So they took the same principles and they applied them to this social network, right? But we are all rats in a fucking rat race on social media. And the thing we're talking about right now is the implications for a community like stand-up in New York City who already suffers from mental illness and mental health crises. Like, how many times have you seen someone post about how they have mental health issues that's a comic on social media? It's almost like everyone I know. I'm having a hard time thinking of someone who hasn't.
Well, I think about this when it comes to ideas of activism in comedy or like an intersection of social justice in comedy. And it seems so difficult that, well, you should never, you should rarely follow a stand-up comic for their political ideology. And the reason is that the personality type that goes into this is often a drama kid. So if you come from theater, you basically are just adopting roles. You're not a real person. Your personality is made up of like the people you pretend to be. And then taking into account the solitary nature of stand-up. So that is not a person that is looking to become part of a community. And then thirdly, the egocentric like nature that you need to have to and the fortitude to continue doing this. It's a recipe for just like the most Ayn Randian person. And then the rewards and incentive structure are, well, if you're good at this, it's not that you're probably not going to go on tour internationally. You're not going to be Russell Peters. You're not going to be Dave Chappelle. You're going to get a Coca-Cola commercial. The goal for most comics is to just have people love them so that they can become the next spokesperson for a Sprint. And who cares what that person's ideology is?
Exactly. And that's the whole thing is like, you either have to be ubiquitous, pansexual, like every person.
A man for all seasons.
Yeah.
A
and person we know for all plenty seasons. Of people like that where I just watch their clapter and I shake my head. And there is so much thirst for that. The Trump sucks. Can I get a round of applause if you think Trump sucks? I see that all the time, and it's sickening to me because they're not contributing original thought to anything. They're not lambasting anything. They're not taking on anything. And by no means does comedy have to be like political, but it should have a point of view.
Well, yeah, and I guess what I'm getting at is like always be skeptical of your favorite comedian's point of view. Because often it is simply what is in vogue at that moment.
100%. So back to what I was saying, it's just that we don't talk about this openly, but social media is a plague, and it's especially a plague on comics. It makes comics insecure where they're already insecure. It makes comics feel low self-worth in general, where we work for drink tickets a lot of the time. So if you are not getting booked, then you feel like nobody cares about you and nobody sees the value you've provided. And yeah. It is that on steroids, because not only is it you're not getting booked right now, it goes, look at this random balloon head who's 20 years old, can't even legally drink, that's getting 100 spots a week because they're telling who ate all the pussy jokes and wearing cool clothes. Like, nobody gives a shit about their jokes. They are just a person who shows up and has a huge targeted following that they've built through various mechanisms. And it's not me being bitter or something for having not the same following. I would never really want that. I don't want the hollowness of it, but I also don't think that it contributes in a good way to our scene and our community. And I know that for a fact. And then to have them be called out by the Wall Street Journal of all places, who's also like a shithole. So it's like, it's like a bully beating up another bully. You're like, you should kill each other.
It's an aliens versus predator situation.
It is. Yeah. I'm like, I hope you both somehow die. So at the end of this. Yeah.
Well, yeah, man, social media. I found that's how I found out today was whatever, Columbus Day. And you're going to hear this a couple days afterwards. But yeah, so every Columbus Day / Indigenous Peoples Day, my stories blow up with infographics to educate me, to remind me of our glorious past. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about Columbus Day, Indigenous Peoples Day. We're going to call it Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yeah, fuck
Day.
A Columbus Day. Fuck yeah. Columbus. That, piece of shit.
I'm just saying that so that people know, anyone that doesn't know about Indigenous Peoples Day, well, we're replacing Columbus with Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yeah, I'm all for it, yes. But I think it's also a joke. And here's why. Because the Biden administration honors both.
I know. That's yeah. That's where we're... Yeah. Jen Psaki just said that today. She's like, well, yeah, it's, you can hold two realities at the same time, maybe.
Yeah, that's horseshit. Yeah. It's like, first of all, Columbus was a scumbag, full-blown scumbag. And he was untrustworthy from his own fucking... Why did Cristobal Colon, a fucking Italian dude, go to Spain?
Because none of the Italians were going to vouch for this guy.
Because he's a scumbag. They're like, this guy's a rat ball and a scum, and we're not going to stake him in his like dumb journey.
Yeah, the Genovese would have paid for it if they had any faith in this dude. The Genoas.
Yeah, but he's a piece of shit, and they knew it. And like, there's a history of him being a piece of shit prior to even this whole thing. But then... if you really look into who the guy was, he's nobody anyone wants to admire or look after. And it shocks me that people are so hung up on the guy because he was a fucking scumbag. Yeah. He's a loser.
And Italians have so many better things to like honor, have days to. Like,
and Machiavelli?
Have a fucking Sopranos Day if you want. Let's put statues yeah. of Tony Soprano up all over the country.
100%. You Not know? After that recent movie, by the way.
Yeah, you weren't a big fan of the Saints of Newark.
Gabe has not seen this movie, and I'm urging him not to. If you're a Sopranos fan, do not watch this movie. Don't do it to yourself. It's seriously, like, horrible. Mike Racine, I was waiting for him to, like, have...
Has he been silent on it?
No, he straight up called it dog shit.
Okay.
Yeah, which
That's
is
great.
Like... Yeah, because, I mean, he loves the show. He had a whole podcast about it. But, God, it's an unwatchable movie, dude. It's really horrible. If you like movies in general, if you never saw the show, this movie would be worse even somehow.
Yeah.
You'd be like, what is this disgusting piece of shit? Every cheap tactic is pulled out and deployed in this movie. It's disjointed. It's absolute dog shit. I want you to watch it for the purpose of enraging yourself. If you have any love for that movie, but in the show, they had a whole episode of people protesting Columbus Day. Remember?
I love that episode. Yeah. Yeah. But there's just so many other things to really have pride in that you don't have to, you know, back this villainous, rapacious colonizer.
Yeah. They've done so many amazing things in Italy and like what? And he was really not operating on behalf of Italy when he did this.
Yeah, he was a free agent. operating yeah. for Spain.
Yeah. He was like a European Union boy. Yeah. He like went to Spain.
Yeah.
He's like, look, they opened the borders. You guys think I'm trash, you Italians. I'm going to go to Spain.
Get an H1 visa. For Spain.
H1B. An H1B.
Yeah.
He's like,
he was Raj in IT for Spain.
What a fucking disgusting piece of shit. But the other thing about Indigenous People Day is like, we wanted to start the podcast off actually by acknowledging this, but we're in Brooklyn and the Canarsie were the natives that were here. And
yeah, shout outs to the Lenni Lenape peoples who were here when the Dutch landed.
Exactly.
And then, you know, so it's funny. At Big Break a couple weeks ago, Mike Albanese was on the show and he's got a really funny joke about Stone Mountain, right? Which is like considered the Confederate Mount Rushmore.
Yes.
And when he said that, I was thinking to myself, but you know what? It's like Mount Rushmore is the Confederate Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, it really is.
And I was thinking about that today for Indigenous Peoples Day, Mount Rushmore in general, which, you know, on okay, so first off, it's got George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Teddy Roosevelt, and Lincoln's faces on them. And it's built in South Dakota by Keystone on this mountain site in the Black Hills that was sacred to the Lakota people. So it's like a sacred spot for them that was called like this, the, you know, the six grandfathers. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but so there, it's already a place where Indigenous peoples went to pray, and the United States government's like, nah, let's carve these white European settlers' faces into the wall of this natural place that you guys respect and love. And George Washington, what a creep. That guy was a creep. Yo, people don't acknowledge that. And my favorite anecdote about his is there was an enslaved woman who was 22 years old named Ona Judge. And after he became president, he would bring Martha, his wife, would bring Ona Judge with them to Philadelphia, which was like the capital of the United States at the time. So they'd bring their servants with them, their enslaved people. And even though Philadelphia was in the north where slavery was not like kosher, you could have your enslaved person with you for like a window of time. And as long as you left within, I don't know, it was like 30 days, let's say. So like if they stayed 31 days, it was against the law. So what Martha would do is take her in her like coterie of slaves across the border and then bring them back like the next day so that like the clock would start over again. And Ona ran away and got to New Hampshire where she lived out her life. But throughout George's life, and Martha's, they harried and hunted her down because they're petty bitches. So like she got her freedom, but they just kept trying to get her back.
Dude, so, worst people.
The worst people. So shout outs to Ona Judge, a true American hero.
Yo, fucking the George Washington equation too. Like what a gross man. Like if you look back to these people that everyone evangelizes as being the forefathers,
yeah,
they never bathed. Their teeth fell out like crackheads.
People thought he had wooden teeth, but he actually had human teeth.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, but they weren't his.
They were someone else's.
Yeah, guess who's?
Who's?
A formerly enslaved person's teeth, man.
Where
do you think upper class dentures came from?
Wooden teeth.
No, dude.
So he like grabbed someone else's jaw like a fucking psycho.
These guys wore African people's teeth.
Stop it.
No, that's where they got them.
That's a real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was like, how does wooden teeth work? You know, because moisture and like the way wood
You basically works. Have to be a ghoulish vampire and take someone else's body parts and put them in your mouth.
Yeah, he was a scum. He was scum, dude. And the thing that also it just explodes my mind is that they wore those like cornball wigs like from Spirit Halloween. And I'm just like, how on earth would you trust a fool that wore like a demented white wig their whole life? And then you don't know what their fucking head. I mean, well,
And we know, look, we know Thomas Jefferson had like a like
billion slaves.
Yeah, and like a like a sex dungeon that he kept.
Yeah, because he was a rapist.
Yeah, exactly.
He was like a hardcore serial rapist.
So that guy had a creepy like Silence of the Lambs room, like Buffalo Bill style, where he kept Sally Hemings. And I, you know, whatever, founding father. So those are two faces on the wall on the mountain. And then even Lincoln, who obviously shout outs for the Emancipation Proclamation, and everybody gives him a pass. And he has done some, you know, that was a transformative moment in U.S. history. But at the exact same time, his policies for expansion out west were no different than any other president prior to him.
Yeah, he wasn't like a civil rights activist.
No, man. They were trying to colonize the West and close the West. And he put down several indigenous insurrections out West and led to one of the greatest mass hangings of Native American men. He sentenced 303 Indian men to be hung during the Dakota War in the Minnesotas. And ended up hanging 38. And then Teddy Roosevelt, of course, was a rancher before he became president. And I think somewhere he wrote down, the only good Indian is a dead Indian.
Oh, he's a classic piece of shit. All of these guys. And so here's the thing a lot of people don't even acknowledge with the Black Hills is like you said, was sacred to the indigenous people. And then they sandblast all these like dickheads' faces on there. And they're not relevant right now. And they shouldn't be relevant. They should have never been relevant. And the whole obsession with them is due to the history books contorting their actual legacy.
Even the guy who designed the Mount Rushmore statues was in the Klan.
Oh, hell yeah.
So how about that?
He was like a cuckold. He's like, I wish George Washington's could fuck my wife, but he's dead now. I'm going to make him look real good now.
Yeah, and it's super recent when we think about that Mount Rushmore is sort of like a monument to our glorious past. I mean, it was built from, or carved from, 1927 to 1941. So really, it's pretty modern.
Fairly recent.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it should have never been carved. And it was a dominance thing. It was like, look at our shitty fucking vampire tooth freaks that were regaling us heroes. Tickens me, man. The places I would never go. I haven't gone, and I would never go. But,
you know, I went on a road trip across the country.
I honestly don't blame you, though.
And, yeah, I mean, you know, when I went there, the coolest thing to do, honestly, seeing it was whatever, lackluster. But I went spelunking at the same time, and because there's a bunch of cave systems around there. And, you know me, I love horror movies. One of my faves is The Descent. Yes. So I asked the teenagers that worked at this cave, I was like, have you guys seen The Descent? And they like rolled their eyes as though they'd heard it all the time. And they were like, yeah, we had a sleepover in this cave system yesterday, and we watched it on our laptop, which is the craziest. The one time I probably wouldn't watch that film would be a mile underground in a dusty old cave surrounded by bat guano.
Dude, bat guano is very useful for growing plants, by the way.
Yeah, it's very flammable, too.
Yeah, I would just never go into a cave. Imagine being a mile underground in a cave and the fucking thing collapses. Like, are they really coming to save you?
No one's coming to save you.
No one's coming to save you. Like,
unless you're a Chilean miner.
Yeah, I was amazed by that whole thing because they were like, look, we'll spend $1 billion getting these 12 people out. In America, they'd be like, they're casualties. They're gone. Sucks.
Sure.
Yeah. But they are heroes for our freedom. This was one of the most natural progressions we've had for like an episode of Halal Cartels.
Yeah, we learned a lot about social media.
Yeah, I mean, I could go on for days about it, but that was a little foray into it. It is toxic. It is definitely, it's not like eating a pill or taking a drug that'll kill you, but it'll slowly kill you. Psychologically and mentally, it'll destroy you. So,
yeah. So, you know, get on WhatsApp, get on a group thread with your friends, send fun memes, find other ways to engage.
Or just get massive enough where you don't have to use social media because you have management and all of them that are just pumping out your shit.
We got another show. It's this Wednesday.
Absolutely.
So when this comes out, probably on Wednesday, after you finish listening to us here, come check us out at Funhouse Comedy, Pete's Candy Store. The show is at 10 p.m. and it's always free.
That's right. And it's been great. So get there early.
We'll yes.
Come through around 9:30. And when's the next big break?
The next big break is going to be the 23rd of October. So October 23rd, come out to Big Break. And if you are in Chicago, you can see me at the Lincoln Lodge at 7 p.m. and at 8 p.m. on Friday and 7 p.m. And then also at 11 p.m. on Friday. And on Saturday, you can see me at 8 p.m. at the Lincoln Lodge in Chicago.
Hell yeah, man. You're going to love it. You should eat like a boss in Chicago.
Yeah, I got to look up. Hey, anybody have any ideas for where I should eat? Send me an email at Halal Cartels or tweet me at Halal Cartels or at Gabe_Pacheco on Twitter.
Yeah, and hit me up at Samirman on Instagram and Twitter. And as always, send us questions, comments, whatever, halalcartels@gmail.com. We were just talking tonight. We're going to have some merch coming out very, very soon. Finally, and I'm really excited about it. So keep an eye out on social media. And if you want to support, that's a great way to support. We'd love to see photos of you wearing the merch. And we're looking forward to seeing those.
All right. And now, here's some sweet tunes by our friend Serene Patel, Brown Privilege.